This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment. Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, truth and lies. Ideas about navigating a world where facts seem to be up for debate, whether it's science or history or even a presidential election. And why some people refuse to believe things that most of us would say are undeniable. When you first heard this idea about Holocaust denial, what'd you think?
I laughed.
Really?
I laughed. I said, you know, those are like the flat earth people or the Elvis is alive people. It was just stupid.
This is Deborah Lipstadt. She's a professor of history at Emory University in Atlanta, where she focuses on the Holocaust. And she remembers hearing about Holocaust deniers back in the 1980s. And even though she thought the idea was absurd, she was curious about who these people were. So she started to look at their arguments.
Oh, they were saying things like gas chambers were an impossibility. They were saying that survivors were making this all up. And if there were Jews who were somehow persecuted, they deserved it for other reasons. And they did something else. They found a new name, revisionists, simply out to revise mistakes in history. I describe them as wolves in sheep's clothing. Hmm. This was not a cognitive lapse. They came to this topic with an anti-Semitic view so that the prism through which their view of history, of this history, was refracted, was shaped, was bent, was a anti-Semitic, racist, pro-Nazi prism.
But the deniers made themselves appear legitimate. They published a journal. They founded an institute. They used footnotes. And Deborah felt the best way to expose them was to write a book about them. And what happened next? Here's Deborah Lipstadt on the TED stage.
I published my work. The book was published, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. And I was done with those folks and ready to move on. Then came the letter from Penguin UK. I opened the letter, and it informed me that David Irving was bringing a libel suit against me in the United Kingdom for calling him a Holocaust denier. Who was David Irving? David Irving was a writer of historical works, most of them about World War II, and virtually all of those works took the position that the Nazis were really not so bad, and the Allies were really not so good. He knew the documents, he knew the facts, but he somehow twisted them to get this opinion. This was a man who not only was a Holocaust denier, but seemed quite proud of it. Here was a man, and I quote, who said, "I'm going to sink the battleship Auschwitz." Here was a man who pointed to the number tattooed on a survivor's arm and said, "How much money have you made from having that number tattooed on your arm?" This was not a man who seemed at all ashamed or reticent about being a Holocaust denier.
What did the book say about him?
I was pretty harsh on him in the book, but if I devoted 300 words to him, that's a lot. Hmm. You know, there were a couple of references, brief references, but I think he chose me because other people had written very negative things about him, even more extreme than I had written. But he waited till, I think, an American, someone from, as the Brits say, across the pond, wrote about him, because to defend yourself against libel charges,
in the United Kingdom is very onerous and very expensive because the burden of proof is on you to prove the truth of what you wrote, unlike in the United States, where if David Irving had sued me here, he would have had to prove the falsehood.
Why would he deny something so painfully and obviously true?
My sense was that he loves to be a contrarian. He loves to do the quote-unquote outrageous. He was very enamored of Adolf Hitler. So I think there were a lot of things operating there, including a desire to take a contrary point of view because he knew that would get him a lot of attention.
Now, lots of my academic colleagues counseled me, Deborah, just ignore it. They said, who's going to believe him anyway? But here was the problem. If I didn't fight, he would win by default. And if he won by default, he could then legitimately say, my David Irving version of the Holocaust is a legitimate version. And what is that version? There was no plan to murder the Jews. There were no gas chambers. There were no mass shootings. Hitler had nothing to do with any suffering that went on. And the Jews have made this all up. I couldn't let that stand and ever face a survivor or a child of survivors. I couldn't let that stand and consider myself a responsible historian. So we fought. Spoiler alert, we won. The judge found David Irving to be a racist, an anti-Semite. He lied, he distorted, and most importantly, he did it deliberately. We showed a pattern in over 25 different major instances, not small things. Many of us in this audience write books. We always make mistakes. That's why we're glad to have second editions. But these always moved in the same direction. Blame the Jews, exonerate the Nazis. What we did is follow his footnotes back to his sources. And what did we find? Not in most cases and not in the preponderance of cases, but in every single instance where he made some reference to the Holocaust, that his supposed evidence was distorted, half-truth, date changed, sequence changed. We didn't prove what happened. We proved that what he said happened, and by extension, all deniers, because he either quotes them or they get their arguments from him, is not true. They don't have the evidence to prove it.
Deborah, during that period of time, which I guess was like 6 years of your life, going back and forth to London and facing this man in court, was it hard for you? I mean, did it take an emotional toll on you?
And it was very difficult because every day there'd be survivors in the courtroom. Hmm. But it wasn't just from survivors. One day, David Irving was in court, and what deniers like to do, because they have to explain how, when the Allies got to the concentration camps, how come they found people there who looked more like cadavers than like real people? So what deniers say, David Irving amongst them, is that, they were being very well taken care of by the Germans, but then the Allies bombed the pharmaceutical factories, the food factories, the roads leading to the camp, and the Germans couldn't take care of them, so that's why they looked so terrible. While he was making that claim, and Richard Evans was on the stand, our lead historical witness, and challenging him very strongly on it, I happened to look at the gallery, and there was an elderly gentleman, I would say he was in his late 70s, and he looked very distressed. I didn't know what it was about, and I didn't pay it too much mind. And at the end of that session, I saw that he was standing there, and he came over to me, and he said, "Madam, I was part of the British Army that liberated the camps. And madam, it galls me to hear that man say that what we found in the camps was because the Germans couldn't take care of these people," he said. Then he paused, he said, "Madam, get the bastard, madam." And he walked off. And that was very powerful too. It just gave me a sense that there were a lot of people who felt a lot was riding on this case.
When you think about the outcome of that trial, was that it? Was it done? Was that, at that point, were you able to sort of breathe out and say, okay, Holocaust denial has just been quashed?
No, I'm smart enough, and I'm sorrily, I have, you know, the wisdom of experience to know that it hadn't been totally quashed. I knew it wasn't over. I didn't think we would see the prejudice, the anti-Semitism resurrected, come to life again the way we're seeing it now.
What are you seeing now?
Look, we're not seeing anything that compares to a Holocaust. We're not seeing anything that compares to the anti-Semitism of decades past. But we're seeing what I call softcore denial. The not denying the facts, but rewriting the facts. And what deniers are trying to do, and it's not just deniers, it's other groups as well. It's white supremacists. It's people who make all sorts of extreme claims about vaccines, about climate, or whatever, to take totally unfounded statements, which we might call lies, dress them up as edgy, extreme opinions. And once they become part of the conversation, then they encroach upon the facts. And it is a modus operandi that I saw amongst deniers, and little did I ever imagine I would see it in so many other arenas as well.
So why is my story more than just the story of a quirky, long, six-year, difficult lawsuit, an American professor being dragged into a courtroom? What message does it have? I think in the context of the question of truth, it has a very significant message. Because today, we live in an age where truth is on the defensive. We must go on the offensive. When someone makes an outrageous claim, even though they may hold one of the highest offices in the land, if not the world, we must say to them, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? We must hold their feet to the fire. We must not treat it as if their lies are the same as the facts. Truth and fact are under assault. The job ahead of us is great. The time to fight is short. We must act now. Thank you very much.
Professor Deborah Lipstadt, she teaches history at Emory University. By the way, there's a movie about the trial. It's called Denial. You can find Deborah's full talk at TED.com. On the show today, truth and lies, ideas about living in a world where facts seem to be up for debate. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, everyone. Just a quick thanks to two of our sponsors who help make this podcast possible. First, to ZipRecruiter.com. If you're looking for top talent with ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Let ZipRecruiter's powerful technology match your job to the right candidates and use their simple dashboard to find the right hire. That's why 80% of jobs on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just one day. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/radiohour. Thanks also to Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage gives you confidence when it comes to buying a new home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand all the details so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/ideas. Jessica?
Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030.
Before we get back to the show, did you ever wonder what it would be like to live in the Pleistocene era or how long it would take to get to the nearest star outside our solar system? Well, if your answer is yes, you have to check out NPR's first ever podcast, especially for kids and their grown-ups. And I'm one of the hosts. It's called Wow in the World, and it's about the wonder all around us. So if you know curious kids between the ages of 4 and 10, check it out. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say they are going to love it. You can find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts at npr.org/wow or however you get your podcasts. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about truth, lies, and denial. I want to start by asking about this word denialism. What is it? What's your definition of it?
Denialism is something that is kind of rejecting an obvious truth for a much more comfortable lie.
This is Michael Spector. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of a book called Denialism.
I tend to write about science and society, often genetics, sometimes the environment, public health.
Actually, to be more specific, he writes a lot about climate change, vaccines, and GMOs. So you can imagine what his email inbox looks like. And when Michael gave his TED Talk back in 2010, he was really mad. He was mad about all the denialism out there.
People wrap themselves in their beliefs, and they do it so tightly that you can't set them free. Not even the truth will set them free. And listen, everyone's entitled to their opinion. They're even entitled to their opinion about progress. But you know what you're not entitled to? You're not entitled to your own facts. Sorry, you're not. And this took me a while to figure
this talk out. Actually ends on kind of a hopeful note, that things are going to get better, that people are going to agree on facts again. But if you ask Michael today, 7 years later?
Oh, I think it's much worse today. I don't see how we couldn't say it's worse than it was when I gave that talk. And that, to me, is very distressing.
Here's more of Michael Spector from the TED stage.
Vaccines, modern medicine, our ability to feed billions of people, those are triumphs of the scientific method. And to my mind, the scientific method is one of the great accomplishments of humanity. A kid born in New Delhi today can expect to live as long as the richest man in the world did 100 years ago. I mean, think about that. It's an incredible fact. And why is it true? Smallpox. Smallpox killed billions of people on this planet. It's gone. It's vanished. We vanquished it. In the rich world, diseases that threatened millions of us just a generation ago no longer exist, hardly. Diphtheria, rubella, polio. Does anyone even know what those things are? But here's the thing that keeps me up at night. We're on the verge of amazing, amazing events in many fields. And yet, I actually think we'd have to go back hundreds, 300 years before the Enlightenment to find a time when we battled progress, when we fought about these things more vigorously on more fronts than we do now. This guy was a hero, Jonas Salk. He took one of the worst scourges of mankind away from us. Polio, poof, gone. That guy in the middle, not so much. His name is Paul Offit. He just developed a rotavirus vaccine with a bunch of other people. It'll save the lives of 400, 500,000 kids in the developing world every year. Pretty good, right? Well, it's good, except that Paul goes around talking about vaccines and says how valuable they are. When Paul speaks in a public hearing, he can't testify without armed guards. He gets called at home because people like to tell them that they remember where his kids go to school. And why? Because Paul made a vaccine.
Let's talk about facts for a moment. What are the facts about vaccines, about the measles vaccine, the MMR vaccine, the polio vaccine? What are the facts about them?
The facts are that in general, they are incredibly, incredibly safe, and that if you gave 100 million children the basic set of vaccines and then you took 100 million children and didn't get them, enormous numbers of the unvaccinated would be sick and die. And the ones who were vaccinated would be fine. Now, if you vaccinate 100 million people, a couple people's immune system are going to go haywire as a result. For those people and for their parents, that's a tragedy. And it is ridiculous to pretend it isn't. But it's also ridiculous not to do the math, which includes a numerator and a denominator. Because when you talk about vaccines, you have to say, is there a risk? And the answer is always yes. But you also have to ask what the risk of not doing things is. And the risk of not doing something like vaccinating your children is enormous.
So there are millions of people who take issue with this idea that vaccines are safe, who have the same access to all the data and facts that you have and I have, but who have come to a completely different conclusion. So what explains it? Why?
Well, I think we have to step away just from vaccines. I think this is true in many areas of life now, and people can see radically different things and take radically different things out of the same data. And part of it is fear. I think we're afraid of losing control of our world. People are anxious that they can't control their lives, and so they want to say no.
Do you think that, I mean, oftentimes people who deny things that you might view as just painfully obvious truths, they claim to be skeptics. And skepticism is a widely accepted, you know, scientific perspective.
It's a requirement.
Yeah.
The problem with skepticism is it's getting a bad name. Skepticism is questioning. The scientific method is one in which you try things out and then you try to poke holes in it. And you assume you will be able to poke holes in it. And if you do, then great, this doesn't work. And if it does work, you use that until you find something better. And for the last 400 years, that system, it has brought us the modern world. It has, the changes are very dramatic, and we sometimes act as if things are getting worse, and they're not.
Like, for example, when it comes to genetically engineered foods, or GMOs, it's another topic where Michael says the scientific consensus is pretty clear.
Every single thing we eat, every grain of rice, every sprig of parsley, every Brussels sprout has been modified by man. You know, there weren't tangerines in the Garden of Eden. There wasn't any cantaloupe. There weren't Christmas trees. We made it all. We made it over the last 11,000 years. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. We got rid of the stuff that didn't. Now we can do it in a more precise way. And there are risks, absolutely. But why are we fighting it? Well, the things I constantly hear are, too many chemicals, pesticides, hormones. We don't want companies patenting life. We don't want companies owning seeds. And you know what my response to all of that is? Yes, you're right. Let's fix it. It's true. We've got a huge food problem, but this isn't science. This has nothing to do with science. It's law, it's morality, it's patent stuff. The idea that we should not allow science to do its job because we're afraid is really very deadening, and it's preventing millions of people from prospering.
I have students at Bard College where I sometimes teach, and the first question I ever ask any of them is, how many of you tried to avoid eating GMOs? And they pretty much all raise their hands. And I say, fine. And then I say, how many of you have heard of vitamin A rice? It's a rice that's been infused with a vitamin it doesn't have, and if it is fed to hundreds of thousands and millions of kids in Southeast Asia and Africa, they wouldn't go blind. And that is not owned by any company. The patent is free. There is no profit-making motive attached to it in any way whatsoever. And when I ask students what they think about that, they all say, wow, that's great. So I say, fine, well, now we're at all pro-GMO in this class and we have to work out the details.
I mean, it seems like a lot of mistrust and denialism and rejection of science isn't really about the science at all, but it's more about rejecting authority and institutions and power.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that's understandable. People have been lied to. They know that corporations don't always tell the truth. They know that governments don't always tell the truth. But I also think there's a solution, and it's a very difficult solution, but it's the only solution, which is education. I hate to pick on scientists because I spend a lot of time around them. They don't reach out very much. I mean, I've been writing about this for now decades, and if there's one thing I can promise you, facts are not enough. I won't say they don't matter, but they're not enough. You need to connect with people on a basic level about things. And when you do that, they respond. But we don't sit down and talk to them. We just preach.
Michael Spector, he writes for The New Yorker. His book is called Denialism. You can see his entire talk at TED.com. On the show today, truth and lies. Ideas about what happens when the truth gets distorted in such a way that it makes it kind of hard to tell what's real.
And in this case, it's questioning whether the elections in the U.S. are fair, questioning whether the democratic institution that's most seen at the heart of legitimacy for the American presidency is all a sham.
This is Laura Galante. She's a cybersecurity consultant.
I discuss cybersecurity and kind of the intersection of politics and technology.
And Laura's talking about the hacking and the leaks that happened during the U.S. election in 2016.
That there is renewed confidence that Russia is in fact behind the cyber break-in.
Efforts to damage the political process in the United States.
By foreign hackers to influence the election.
So just a refresher, last summer the Democratic National Committee was hacked and a collection of emails from senior Democratic leaders was leaked and then published by WikiLeaks. And some of those emails made it seem like the DNC wasn't neutral in the primary election battle between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
And when that information goes public, the way that that gets picked up by the press and the way that those emails are portrayed start to play into that very concept that the U.S. process and the concept of voting was all sort of a sham or being puppeteered by the parties and wasn't something that was really organically based on people's sentiment and their vote in the primaries. So I think what you see is an opening that the Kremlin was interested in figuring out how to exploit, which is a lack of trust in the standard institutions that America had seen and trusted for its democratic process. You're never going to get with any of this, in particular with Russia, Professor Plum in the parlor with a pipe, right? But what was clear is, regardless of the outcome, Russia stood to benefit if the U.S. political system was in chaos.
And by seeding doubt in America's democratic institutions, the hackers created a climate that made it more plausible to deny the truth. And the internet made that process happen seamlessly.
The dependence that we have for not just our news, but really for how we're thinking about our collective experience as people and as a country and as a world is just so intensely derived from the internet right now. I mean, your smartphone is more your reality than walking down the street. So it's now time to figure out what seems fake, what seems real, why that's the case, and you don't yet have the same spidey feeling or, you know, goosebumps on the back of your neck that you get when you're walking down the street and there's a shady character walking down and, you know, you're not going to trust something that they say or take it at face value. You don't have that feeling yet on the internet.
Here's Laura Galante on the TED stage.
As our realities are increasingly based on the information that we're consuming at the palm of our hand and from the news feeds that we're scanning and the hashtags and stories that we see trending, the Russian government was the first to recognize how this evolution had turned your mind into the most exploitable device on the planet. And your mind is particularly exploitable if you're accustomed to an unfettered flow of information now increasingly curated to your own tastes. This panorama of information that's so interesting to you gives a state, or anyone for that matter, a perfect backdoor into your mind. It's this new brand of state-sponsored information operations that can be that much more successful, more insidious, and harder for the target audience, that includes the media, to decipher and characterize. If you can get a hashtag trending on Twitter or chum the waters with fake news directed to audiences primed to receive it, all tactics used in Russian operations, then you've got a shot at effectively camouflaging your operations in the mind of your target. This is what Russia's long called reflexive control. It's the ability to use information on someone else so that they make a decision on their own accord, that's favorable to you.
Why are we so susceptible to that kind of manipulation?
We love
particularly in the West, we love having all of this information coming at us that we get to kind of pick and choose what we like, right? So the more that we have a sort of buffet of information at our fingertips and we get to choose what pieces we want to consume, the more we feel like we've helped construct our truth. Mm. But if there's two dishes on that buffet that never would have been there naturally, right, or look extra enticing, we're more willing to choose them. So in a sense, because we are so accustomed to this kind of unfettered flow of information, it's given a malicious actor the ability to have that kind of seamless blend into the panorama of information that's in front of you. And if something fits with how we want our world to look through our rosy-colored glasses, then that information seems a bit more credible. We must recognize that this place where we're increasingly living, which we've quaintly termed cyberspace, isn't defined by ones and zeros, but by information and the people behind it. This is far more than a network of computers and devices. This is a network composed of minds interacting with computers and devices. And for this network, there's no encryption, there's no firewall, no two-factor authentication, no password complex enough to protect you. What you have for defense is far stronger. It's more adaptable. It's always running the latest version. It's the ability to think critically, call out falsehood, press for the facts. And above all, you must have the courage to unflinchingly pursue the truth.
I just can't get past this idea that we are so vulnerable as species and as citizens, that we're so vulnerable to believing misinformation, to believing lies. I mean, you think about history, and we look back at these black and white reels of, like, Italians, cheering on Mussolini and Germans cheering on Hitler, and we think, oh, God, how stupid could they have been? I mean, gosh, we would never do that today. And some of this stuff makes me think, well, is that true?
I think there's a Reagan quote that is, we're always one generation away from losing our freedom.
But freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream.
It's very easy to forget how hard people fought to live in a place where you could say what you wanted to say and you wouldn't be feared to be in jail. Or, you know, or political dissonance was something that came with, you know, a good, healthy democracy. These concepts aren't something that are granted to us. They are not unalienable rights. They're something you fight for. And if we can collectively reassert that we want a democracy that is based on these principles without having to go through a war, without having to have World War II, without having to have the Dark Ages to get to the Enlightenment, without having to, you know, have a massive all-out fight, then I think that will be the ultimate mark of whether we've overcome this as a species.
Laura Galante is a cybersecurity expert based in Washington, D.C. You can see her full talk at TED.com.
And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Thank you. On the show today, ideas about what's real and what's not. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, everyone. Just a quick thanks to two of our sponsors who help make this podcast possible. First, to Capital One, who believes a good credit score can keep your mind at peace. You work hard making smart financial decisions at every point. Keep your credit strong with the CreditWise app from Capital One. With CreditWise, you can view your TransUnion credit score and get alerts each time your credit is pulled and when your credit report changes. And CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. So download the free CreditWise app today to find a state of credit enlightenment. Thanks also to WordPress.com. Every small business wants to find their customer base. And now your customers can find you too when you create a website on WordPress.com. WordPress powers 27% of all websites. They have hundreds of customized themes to get you started. Just pick a template and make it your own. Plus 24/7 support when you need it, so you can get back to business. Go to WordPress.com/RadioHour to get 15% off your website today. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, truth and lies. And what happens when people deny things that are objectively true? Like this story you might remember from a couple of years ago. Can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Stephanie Vasari, and I head up CNN's bureau in Lagos, Nigeria.
On the night of April 14th, 2014, something terrible happened that brought Stephanie to Nigeria.
Hundreds of young girls, fast asleep in their beds, are awakened by the sound of gunfire.
276 schoolgirls were waiting to sit an exam in a Chibok government secondary school in northeast Nigeria, Borno State. And overnight, the Boko Haram trucks arrived and these men burst in. Some of them were dressed as army, the military. And at first, they thought it was the army. But they soon quickly realized that these were men who didn't have good intentions for them. And they were all rounded up. Some of them were on the phone to their parents, so the parents could hear their daughters being kidnapped. And just packed them all up and gathered them into trucks and kidnapped them.
Boko Haram is an insurgency group that's been terrorizing northeast Nigeria for the past decade. And the story of the kidnapped girls, it quickly spread all around the world.
There can only be one reaction to a story like this, and it's outrage, mass outrage.
Politicians, celebrities, activist groups, they all banded together. A huge social media campaign emerged, and their rallying cry, "Bring back our girls." Even Michelle Obama made a video pleading for their return.
My husband and I are outraged and heartbroken over the kidnapping of...
Meanwhile, Stephanie Busari was sent to Nigeria by CNN to investigate the story. And what she discovered surprised her, because it turned out a lot of Nigerians didn't think the story was true. They thought it was all a big hoax made up by the Nigerian government. Stephanie picks up the story from the TED stage.
Influential Nigerians were telling us at the time that we were naive, we didn't understand the political situation in Nigeria. But they also told us that the story of the Chibok girls was a hoax. Sadly, this hoax narrative has persisted, and there are still people in Nigeria today who believe that the Chibok girls were never kidnapped. For 2 years, inevitably, the news agenda moved on, and for 2 years, we didn't hear much about the Chibok girls. Everyone presumed they were dead. But in April last year, I was able to obtain this video that Boko Haram filmed as a proof of life. But before I could publish it, I had to travel to the northeast of Nigeria to talk to the parents to verify it. One of the mothers, when she watched the video, told me that if she could have reached into the laptop and pulled out her child from the laptop, she would have done so. For those of you who are parents, like myself in the audience, you can only imagine the anguish that that mother felt. This video would go on to kickstart negotiation talks with Boko Haram. And a Nigerian senator told me that because of this video, they entered into those talks because they had long presumed that the Chibok girls were dead.
So here's what I don't get, Stephanie. Why did people think that this was a hoax when it was so obviously true? I mean, there was tons of evidence.
I think certainly people are very cynical here. They're distrustful because they've been lied to and cheated and you know, they've been through successive waves of governments who have not necessarily had their best interests at heart. So the default stance definitely is cynicism and you know, skepticism. But, you know, with the Chibok girls, that was, for me, the most widespread example of people dismissing something that was so patently true. I'd never experienced that on such a wide scale.
So this idea doesn't come from nowhere. I mean, it comes from a long history of governments basically lying, and people are like, what do you expect us to believe?
Yes.
So what do you think that people can do to, you know, to fight against this perception of fake news?
I just want people to be more careful about the information that they share, that they discover online, because people are so quick to believe what a piece of information that suits their agenda, that mirrors their worldview. They don't want to delve deeper to say, actually, you know what? Is this really true? Who is publishing this? Who has said this? And why do they say it? And what do they have to benefit from saying this? So, you know, do a bit more research. Don't just share it or take it at face value, you know?
Mm-hmm. Are there still a lot of people in Nigeria who still think this story is a hoax?
Less and less so now. The girls have started to come back because of negotiation talks with Boko Haram and Nigerian government. And you know what can't be faked is the scenes of unbridled joy at the reunion with the parents and their daughters. One mother picked up her daughter and put her on her back. You know, like how mothers carry babies on their back? She tried to put her on her back. And you cannot forget scenes like that. So people are seeing these things and they're saying, okay, hang on a second, you know, maybe it wasn't fake. So, but, you know, even now people believe that it's fake. The Chibok girl story is fake. It's fake news. And I think people just believe what they want to believe in that instance.
Stephanie Busari is a reporter for CNN in Lagos, Nigeria. You can hear her full talk at TED.com. So for an episode about what's true and what's not, we thought we'd end the show with a ghost story.
I was living in Sherman Oaks, which is a suburb of L.A.
This is writer Carrie Poppy.
In a tiny guest house off of someone else's home. And the guest house was clearly ramshackle.
And it was there that Carrie experienced something that, at the time, she couldn't really explain.
So it started because I went to an occult bookstore and I was overwhelmed by this negative feeling. What at the time it would have called a bad spiritual presence. And then later that day when I went home, I felt it again and I thought, oh, this spirit has followed me home.
What did it feel like?
Well, at first it wasn't physical. It was just, you know, the feeling of being stared at, so to speak. But then it started to grow into a physical feeling. So I felt a pressure on my chest. I started to get auditory hallucinations.
What were you hearing?
I would hear this whoosh, like as if something was passing by me, maybe the sound of the ocean, you might say. And yeah, and then just this disquieting feeling that something was there.
Did you think that something was there?
Oh, I was convinced something was there.
You thought there was a ghost in that house?
I thought a demon was there.
Carrie Poppy picks up the story from the TED stage.
Every day I'd come home, and you guys, this feeling got so bad. I would sit there in bed and I would cry every night. And the feeling on my chest got worse and worse. It was physically painful. So finally I got on the internet and I Googled hauntings. And I came upon this forum of ghost hunters, but these were a special kind of ghost hunters. They were skeptics. And I was like, okay, smart guys, this is what's happening to me, and if you have an explanation for me, I would love to hear it. And one of them said, okay, have you heard of carbon monoxide poisoning? And I said, yeah, like gas poisoning? So carbon monoxide poisoning is when you have a gas leaking into your home. And I looked it up, and The symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning include a pressure on your chest, auditory hallucinations, whoosh, and an unexplained feeling of dread. So that night, I called the gas company. I said, I have an emergency. They came out. I said, I suspect a gas leak. They brought their carbon monoxide detector. And the man said, it's a really good thing that you called us tonight, because you could have been dead very soon.
Wow. Amazing. This was a gas leak. It was a gas leak.
Yeah, I was being slowly poisoned.
It must have been both simultaneously terrifying that you were sucking in gas and also quite, you know, eye-opening and liberating that it was not a ghost.
Oh, yeah, and it was mostly the latter.
Hmm.
I mean, truly, because that has such an immediate solution. Get out of the house. That's it. Hmm. The end. The world isn't full of demons. You don't have to live your whole life worried that you'll walk into another haunted house. Call the gas company if you feel this again. That's it. The world is so much simpler than you feared.
And that whole ordeal actually inspired Carrie to become an investigative journalist. She now goes out and gathers evidence to explain outlandish claims and paranormal sightings.
I mean, I'm most interested in why we believe the things we believe. And can they just be these little experiences that we take for granted that there's a otherworldly cause when there may be a totally earthly cause?
Carrie also hosts a podcast
called Ono, Ross, and Carrie.
Hello, welcome to Ono, Ross, and Carrie, the show where we don't just talk about fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal, but take part ourselves.
So we join fringe groups, we test kind of wacky treatments on ourselves, and we explore all these questions that seem unusual and outside the bounds of science to see if they're actually true.
So in the name of truth, Carrie has joined the Church of Scientology.
I actually audited Ross and he audited me.
She overdosed on homeopathic pills.
And absolutely nothing happened because there's nothing in homeopathy.
Carrie went through an exorcism.
It went on for a good 15 minutes. And by the end of it, they said, you're the hardest exorcism case we've ever had.
And she hunted for ghosts on the Queen Mary.
We did get one recording of an EVP, an electronic voice phenomenon, that sounded like a voice saying, go eat French fries. Not too impressed by that.
I mean, you know this as well as I do. Like, a lot of people believe in ghosts or in paranormal things. And we don't necessarily think that they're crazy or outlandish. It's one of those things that is still kind of a little bit acceptable, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, 37% of Americans believe in haunted houses, for example. That's huge.
Yeah. Do you have an idea of why so many people do believe that?
Believe in ghosts and haunted houses?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Carl Sagan would tell you that it's because we're always looking for agents. So we were evolved to look for anything that would threaten us. When we didn't have homes, when we weren't protected from our natural predators. Now that we don't really need this trick so much, our brain still is trying to do it for us, right? And so that's why we see Jesus in toast. That's why we think we see a face on the front of a neon car. It looks like the car is smiling at us. It's because our brain's always looking for faces and always looking for personalities where there aren't any. And yeah, it's the same thing happening here. It's looking for something that isn't there.
Yeah. I mean, when you come across people in your research who, you know, who are convinced that they're living among ghosts or some kind of, you know, perceived paranormal event is real, do you ever try to say, let me explain the science of this to you?
Absolutely. Hmm. So my idea is that there's outer truth. This is the sort of objective reality. So if you and I get in a car collision and we get out of our cars and we're screaming at each other and you say, I had the right of way. And I say, no, I had the right of way. We're still talking about our beliefs. We're talking about what we believe just happened. But it's an outer reality. One of us is right. And some people are talking about their religious or paranormal beliefs in this sense. They're really saying, there are ghosts or Jesus rose from the dead, and I have evidence of this, and I am willing to talk to you on a scientific basis. I want to engage with you on that level. And if that's the level they want to talk on, game on. But sometimes people talk about their beliefs on this inner truth level. And these people say things like, I believe Jesus rose from the dead. And Carrie, if you don't believe that, that's okay. If that reality doesn't click for you, that's fine. I'm not trying to foist it on you. That's an inner truth for them. That's something that just has this real purpose and meaningfulness for them. And I think a lot of unbelievers like me make this mistake of trying to force them then to discuss it on the outer truth level. And I think that's a mistake. So if it's this sort of inner world that they're living in where they don't want to have that engagement, they want it to be personal, then I try to leave it there.
I've done over 70 investigations like this with my co-host, Ross, and I would love to tell you that 9 times out of 10, science wins, it saves the day, it's all explained. That's not true. The truth is, 10 times out of 10, science wins, it saves the day. And that doesn't mean there's no such thing as a mystery. Of course there are mysteries, but a mystery is a mystery. It is not a ghost. Now, I believe looking for the truth, being open-minded, and being willing to be wrong and to change your whole worldview, it is awe-inspiring. I still get excited at ghost stories every single time. I still consider that every group I join might be right, and I hope I never lose that hope. Let's all never lose that hope. Because searching for what's out there helps us understand what's in here. And also, please have a carbon monoxide detector in your home. Thank you.
Carrie Poppy, she hosts the podcast Oh No, Ross and Carrie. You can see her full talk at TED.com. Hey, thanks for listening to our show, Truth and Lies, this week. If you want to find out more about who was on it, go to ted.npr.org. To see hundreds more TED Talks, check out ted.com or the TED app. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Janae West, Neva Grant, Rund Abdel-Fattah, Casey Herman, and Rachel Faulkner, with help from Thomas Liu and Daniel Shukin. Our intern is Tony Liu. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Colin Helms, Anna Phelan, and Janet Lee. If you want to let us know what you think about the show, you can write us at tedradiohour@npr.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. It's @TedRadioHour. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Hey y'all, Sam Sanders here. These days, I feel like I can't make sense of the news until I've talked it out with my friends. So I made a new show where we do that every week. It's called It's Been a Minute. That's my way of saying let's catch up. Find It's Been a Minute now on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast. Thanks.